Session number 27344, wheel 16.
Wheel 16.
Well, we were talking about flying over the Korea north of the battle line, and our job was to try and stop any supplies getting to the battle line on the west coast of Korea. And there was an American carrier on the east coast doing the same thing, trying to stop supplies and people moving during the day as far as possible. And we did attack everything that moved, virtually, just to try and dissuade them from moving stuff. And it got to the point where they were, in fact, moving ammunition by people carrying it, large numbers of people. I mean, one man might carry two shells, and they would fan out across a fairly wide area and just try and go through the woods and fields. And if we appeared overhead, they would just stop where they were, and they would be wearing clothing which made them blend into the background. And quite often you just didn't see them. And of course, when you flew past, then they got up and walked on again. So in fact, they were able to move quite an amount of stuff, but using an awful lot of people to do it. But one of the things that we used to attack was alongside the railway. They would quite often find quite a large pile of stores, and we never knew what the stores were, whether they were food or ammunition or what. So we used just to try and set it on fire as best we could, firing the ammunition into it, which we hoped would sort of start a fire. And I can remember on one occasion the railway line coming down from the north, snaked to the west round a hill and then turned back south again. And along the northern and western side of the hill, there were stores all along the railway line. So I decided that we would attack this, and my number two and I went down and strafed as far as we could along the stores, trying to set them on fire or whatever, see if there was any ammunition amongst it which might blow up. And we attacked from south to north first, and then I turned round easterly to attack from east to west along the other side of the hill. And to be honest, that is something that one should not do, attack the same thing twice in quick succession, because the first attack alerts them, and the second one, they are alert and ready to fire. So it really wasn't good practice. But I made the mistake of thinking, because I was coming in from a different direction along a different side of the hill, that perhaps we'd take them by surprise. But we didn't. And on the second run from east to west along the side of the hill, there was a lot of anti-aircraft fire. And I warned my number two that they were firing at us and not to spend too long in the dive. So I pulled out of the dive. I wasn't hit at all, and I pulled out of the dive and looked over my shoulder to see what my number two was doing. But unfortunately, on the turn from the first attack, he had got left behind a bit, and he must have been, I should think, at least 30 seconds behind me, if not a minute. So the trouble was that they were alerted, and all of their guns were aiming at one aircraft. And in fact, he was hit, and I saw him crash, and it really saddened me, because it was, to an extent, my fault for having attacked the same target twice. So I wasn't very pleased with myself about that.
The dangers from anti-aircraft fire, were you able to really see where the anti-aircraft fire would come from?
No, it was mainly small arms fire, to tell you the truth. There were places on the coast and close to fixed installations where there was proper anti-aircraft fire with gun positions, which you could see in attack. But on this sort of occasion, it was all small arms fire, And unfortunately, some of it was effective, which is a bit of a bugger. So anyway, that taught me a very sharp lesson that I was not to attack the same target twice in quick succession. Sometimes on the west coast of Korea, the fog would come down very suddenly, take you by surprise. And the trouble was that we had no meteorological information from China at all. So that the Met officer was doing it all from his own observations. And although he might think that perhaps there was going to be fog or low cloud or whatever, he couldn't forecast the time because he didn't know when it was coming in. And sometimes we used to be caught out, and I can remember one occasion when there were 10 of us airborne, and snow clouds came over from China very quickly, right across the Korean Gulf. And when we got back to the ship just wasn't to be found to begin with. But we were very lucky in so much as there were short gaps between the snow showers. And it was a matter of trying to find the ship in the period of a gap. But what we were doing was the two aircraft which had been flying what's called combat air patrol, they had been flying over the ship to defend the ship in case there was any attacks from the North Koreans. And they found a gap and got back on the ship quite quickly. But there were four Fireflies and four Sea Furies, and I was leading the Sea Furies. And we came back to the ship and got into the vicinity of the ship, but really couldn't see it to begin with. And we were flying round, and I said to the Fireflies, you fly round at 800 feet and we'll fly round at 1200 feet and make sure we don't collide because we don't know where we are relative to the ship because we don't know where the ship is. So we had these eight aircraft milling about. And every now and again, there would be a quick glimpse of the ship, so we knew we were in the right vicinity. And we had been over Korea for, I suppose, an hour and a half, and the fuel was getting a bit low. So it was beginning to get a bit, not desperate, but slightly worrying. And then very luckily, there was a gap came along which was big enough for us to see the ship and get back down and land on, and the Fireflies went in first and we went in behind them. And by that time we were very, very well practiced in deck landing procedure, and we could in fact land on the ship at 15 second intervals and still clear the deck ready for the next aircraft to land on, and the deck would have all the wires set and ready in that 15 seconds. So it was a matter of the four Fireflies went round and got on, and I came round to join after them and made it as tight as I could. So that as soon as the four Fireflies were on, the four Sea Furies started to come in as well. And we did get all the eight aircraft on in this gap, which must have been, I suppose, about maybe a 3 minute, 4 minute gap. So we were very lucky. Because after that, when we actually get onto the ship, there were no more gaps appeared. So that would have been just a bit tricky, because this snow was coming over from China, moving across the Korean Sea, and then over North Korea. And all the emergency airfields that we might have used ashore were all in snow as well. So it would have meant eight aircraft ditching if we'd had to, and that would have been just a bit tiresome, to put it mildly. But that was the sort of thing which could happen. It was really quite exciting at the time. But because we had been operating there for, I suppose, some weeks, we were really in absolutely tip-top practice. And we could land on at 15-second intervals without any difficulty at all. And you could get all the aircraft on in less than 3 minutes. And then we were away doing whatever we had to do.
That seems an amazing rate of being able to land on.
Oh, yes. Well, you see, the thing is that There are four wires on the after end of the carrier and two emergency barriers which are operated on hydraulic ramps, and they come up to the height of the aircraft propeller, so that if you miss the wires, you go into this barrier, which is very strong steel wire cables across the deck at propeller height. So you go into it and the propeller catches in the emergency barrier and just brings the aircraft to a halt very quickly, instead of allowing it to carry on ploughing into the deck park up at the forward end. So when you land on, catch the wire, and the wire runs out, and then it starts to pull you back slightly. And as it pulls you back, the wire slackens off and falls off the hook. And the aircraft director is standing on the deck, indicates to you that your hook is clear and your hook is up, in the up position, so it's not going to catch anything else. And then he just waves you forward. So you open your throttle very wide and go over the barriers, which are now flat on the deck. And as soon as you're over the barriers, the two barriers come up again. And the wires all reset, and they get, they're raised to, I suppose, about 6 inches off the deck, so that the hook can catch them quite easily. And that is all reset in 10 seconds.
It seems a very coordinated effort, especially from the people who are on the carrier deck for you coming in there as well.
Well, it's what we practice all the time in carriers, is speed in takeoff and landing, because the carrier doesn't want to be steaming into wind for any longer than it has to do. Because if it's in enemy waters, the longer it's steaming into wind, the better the target is for submarines. And we really like to try and get our deck landing intervals down to certainly less than half a minute between aircraft. And the lower you can get it, the better. So that with four aircraft landing on, you should have the four on in less than a minute. 15 seconds between, you see, and there you have them all on. And with eight aircraft coming on, they should be on in less than 2 minutes if the people in the air and the people on the deck are all doing their job properly. But that's why it takes a long time for a carrier to work up to operational efficiency, because there's so many people have to do their job correctly and at the right time. And the timing is really so important. And the men operating the barriers and the wires are all stokers. And the men operating on the deck, directing the aircraft, are all naval airmen. And of course, it's usually the officers who are flying. So it's all total cooperation between these groups in order to get them operating efficiently. The men operating the catapults up forward to fire the aircraft off, they're all stokers, engineers. And they have to train so that they're efficient, and they've got to train with us so that we're efficient with them. So that a carrier operating at maximum efficiency is a thing to be seen, because it is so perfect in its coordination of people that normally don't do similar work at all. And then again, you see, when you think of it, we land on and we're due to take off again in, shall we say, 2 hours' time. So we've got to be debriefed, so the operational staff are debriefing us and taking all the information they need from us. And then we've got to go and eat. So the cooks and stewards have to be up to scratch as well to provide us with the meal exactly at the time it's required. And then we're back up to be briefed for the next exercise, so the operations staff again are briefing us then. Now, they're all ship's officers. Cooks and stewards are a different department in the ship. And it just means that the whole ship has to be working together precisely. And even the stores have to be absolutely on the ball, because if something goes wrong with the aircraft and they want to have it on the next sortie, they've got 40 minutes to do it. So that the mechanics who are working in the hangar or on the deck, depending on where the space is, they've got to be on the ball as well. So it is a most amazingly efficient fighting machine, a carrier, because of the cooperation required between all the departments to fit in and make it all work in sequence. And I remember there was an occasion when HMS Ocean had been out in Korea in the period ahead of ours, and they had done, I've forgotten the exact number, perhaps 120 or 130 sorties in a day. And that, with the number of aircraft we had, was really very, very good operating time. And their captain had been boasting slightly around the Navy about how efficient his ship was. So anyway, on this particular occasion, the weather was absolutely perfect. And the captain and the commander there had decided that we were going to see if we could at least equal this other ship's activities. So all the air crew flew at least three times and maybe four times in that day. And when it got to tea time, we had 120-something sorties completed. And the captain decided that we weren't going to try to beat their number, we would equal it. So he sent off exactly the right number of aircraft to equal this number that the Ocean had achieved. And surprisingly enough, we finished well before dusk. And the captain sent a signal to this other captain who was still in his ship elsewhere. And the signal said, "What did you do after tea time?" So that's the sort of thing that used to go on. But, I mean, with the number of aircraft we had and the number of air crew we had, that was really working very hard to get that number in a day.
There's a question there of fatigue. How tiring was that for you if you flew that number of
sorties? Oh, you'd certainly be knackered at the end of the day. You would certainly sleep well.
Well, you did actually mention where your cabin was as well. Would it be okay to sleep there? Because, you know, you sort of mentioned how noisy an aircraft carrier could be.
Yes, well, we weren't doing night operations very often at that time. We did try doing night operations, but it was a matter of starting a couple of hours before dawn and taking off at night from the carrier and flying over the area that we knew quite well by this time. But we really only chose to do it when it was moonlight, because there was no way in which we could see hilltops and that sort of thing. And when you're doing ground attack, you do tend to go quite low, and it wouldn't be prudent if you didn't have a fairly reasonable idea where the hills were and that sort of thing. But I suppose, to a certain extent, we were lucky. They didn't have pylons and very tall buildings that we could fly into. But generally speaking, it would be a moonlit night that we would set off and try and catch the trains and stuff moving, because what they used to do was to hide the trains in the tunnels during the day and move them during the night and try and get all the ammunition and stuff from North Korea down to the front line. And our job was interdiction, was to stop the movement of stores and ammunition. And we did try this three or four times, but the fact is that once you started to dive on something you thought was a target, it was a bit unnerving to try and go down to the proper height for strafing, for example. Bombing, I suppose, again, you were a bit wary, because we used to try and drop at such a height that the bombing was reasonably accurate. But when you're diving at night, it is, to put it mildly, slightly frightening. And one tended to release the bomb just a bit high, and as a result, it wasn't nearly accurate enough. So at night, we were really trying to find trains moving and that sort of thing. And it was difficult. And after three or four attempts, we decided that it was more dangerous, and we were likely to lose aircraft due to accidents rather than due to enemy action. But We'd take off maybe an hour and a half before dawn and then come back just after dawn and land on again. But I've forgotten what the question was.
It was about fatigue.
Oh, fatigue. Well, we could fly three times a day and at the end of it would be tired, but not dog tired. But on this particular day, when we flew, many of us flew four times, it was definitely very tiring.
When you were doing the night operations, did you actually ever spot any trains moving?
Not really. Used to sometimes see what looked like the firebox of an engine. And, of course, we were really trying to break up the railways all the time, but bombing a railway on normal dry land, as it were, was always a waste of time because they had so many people available and they'd repair the bomb damage overnight and the trains would be running again next day quite easily. So that wasn't terribly successful. But putting bombs up tunnels was quite successful if you could do it properly. And even bombing bridges and breaking them up didn't cause a very big hiccup because they really used to put the small bridges back overnight and the bigger bridges really quite quickly. The thing is that their construction of the bridge was such that if they judged it would carry the weight of the train went. There was nothing like building another fourth bridge. It was the flimsiest construction, and of course the flimsier the construction, the more difficult it was to knock it down with a bomb because the bomb blast used to go through it rather than knock it down. But that was really the intention, was to stop stuff moving in that area from North Korea down to the front line. I think we were quite successful at it, but as I say, they had the occasions when they would make the men walk with carrying shells.
Was it understood that yours would be a constant effort because of their ability to repair things, that you would have to go back many times to probably the same place?
Oh, yes, absolutely. And it was quite astonishing when you could go back next day and see the bridge that you knew had been blown down was up and running again. But that was it. We were over there constantly, and we were there for 9 days at a time. And then there would be an American carrier would relieve us, and they'd be there for 9 days. And in the 9 days off duty, we would go back to one of the Japanese ports, either Sasebo or Kure, and we would re-ammunition and repair aircraft and give rest and relaxation to everyone in the ship, so that everyone, literally everyone, from the stokers right through to the airmen on the deck, they all had a couple of days' leave during the time in harbour. And it was interesting having a couple of days' leave in Japan because it's such a different way of life there that just even to walk through the towns locally was very interesting. But, of course, as always in these places, we used to drink far too much. You didn't see as much of the town as you might have done, but you saw the bars. But it was very interesting, actually, going around in Japan to just feel the different atmosphere. And it was a different atmosphere entirely.
Where would you drink? Would you drink in the same places as other ranks, or would you have officers' bars that you were in?
Well, usually most of the naval towns had an officers' club. But you might start drinking a couple there and then go on just round the town, and you would certainly meet your own ratings round the town and have a couple of jars with them and then move on elsewhere. It was just having a night out.
Was there any other trouble between the British naval ratings and their American counterparts in those towns?
No, I never heard of any. Not really. No, we got on really quite well, but I can't remember. I suppose the American carriers probably used the same areas as we did, but I can't honestly remember. The two ports that we used were Sasebo and Kure, and they used to sort of alternate. between these two. And we would have, it'd take us at least a day to get back from the operating area to harbour. So I suppose we all had 2 days off while we were in there. And while you were on board, you were busy helping with re-ammunitioning and refueling. And there was also an aircraft carrier called HMS Unicorn, which used to ply between Hong Kong and Korea and Hong Kong and Japan and Singapore and Japan and bring in spare aircraft. So there might be an occasion when we were taking aircraft by lighter from the Unicorn to the operational carrier. And then, of course, it was a matter of getting that aircraft up to operational standards. So there was always quite a lot of work to be done, even in harbour. But the captain used to make sure that we all had time off for rest and relaxation. And it was interesting, there's no doubt about it. I really quite enjoyed that part of it.
So you've got quite an interesting point there when you're saying that the aircraft were replaced.
Yeah.
How long would an aircraft really have in an operational environment? What was its lifespan before it was worn out?
Oh, it was only if it was shot down that it really had a short lifespan. For example, one of the aircraft which is at present in the museum at Yeovilton, and it flies as a display aircraft, a Sea Fury. It's got Lieutenant McKeown's name on it, and that was the aircraft he flew in Korea. So that particular aircraft is 50 years old at least. But we used to, when I was flying at Lossiemouth as an instructor, when we had Sea Furies, the Sea Furies were mainly those that come back from Korea and were put into the flying schools for the students to fly. And as long as it hadn't been shot down, it would carry on flying. The thing is that all the military aircraft have a very regular maintenance routine where they have daily maintenance, sort of a number of hours flying maintenance, say 100 hours flying. They would have a bigger inspection and replacement. And after, I don't know, perhaps 500 hours flying, they'd have a full major dismantling and putting together again. And all the parts that were worn would be replaced. So a major refit on an aircraft could last many months. But at the end of it, it still had the same airframe number. It probably still had quite a few different new parts in it.
Would you ever get, though, a certain aircraft that would have a kind of constant problem with it, that people would say, oh, that one's always got a problem there?
Oh, that has happened, where one particular aircraft would be giving problems. And we used to, the same as you have with cars, you know, you used to call it the Friday car or whatever. But sometimes you'd have an aircraft that would have some minor thing which was a problem. And people would complain about it. The pilot would come back and say it's doing this, that or the other, and the ratings would go and have a look at this, find out what was wrong if they couldn't repair it. And if they couldn't find out what was wrong, they would say inspected and returned to flying. But if there was, for example, a very minor rigging error in one of the flying controls, it might not show up easily in the tests they do. Or if there was something wrong in, I don't know, perhaps an electrical system, which worked most of the time, but not all the time. These are the sort of things. Intermittent faults were the things that were really difficult to try and pin down and get rid of. If it was an obvious fault, when you reported it to the maintenance people, then they would go and investigate and say, oh yes, it was so-and-so. For example, if the engine started spluttering, you could say, well, either it's the plugs or it's this, that or the other. And you could go and they would run the engine up themselves, put it through the exercise, listen to it, diagnose the problem and repair it. That was about it.